Madame André. Montmouchet, Cantal, France. March 21, 1944. Fournier is waiting for us when we return to the encampment. I am driving the stolen Nazi bus, and Hubert follows behind in the Renault. It makes me chuckle to see him behind the wheel. He's a big man, and it looks like he's been crammed into a tin can. Getting through the checkpoints was a bit tricky given my new vehicle, but the Marquis guards recognized me and I had all the passwords, so they let me pass. I pull the bus into the clearing and park halfway to the fire pit. Hubert is at the door and up the steps before I can even get out of my seat and stretch. "Have you ever actually driven a bus before?" he asks. "No. Have you ever hot-wired one before?" He laughs. It's a surprising sound, deep and filled with humor. I don't hear it often enough.
"Many times."
"Well, thank you." He scratches his chin with two fingers. It's been over a week since Hubert had a proper shave, and he's gone a bit woolly as a result.
"What do you intend to do with this anyway? You can't just go riding around in a German transport vehicle."
"I mean to live in it. If I'm going to be stuck in the woods indefinitely, I'd like a bit of privacy and space."
Hubert looks at me as if I've just declared that I'm going to set up residence in the Louvre. "You are going to live in this?"
He sniffs.
"Smells like Nazi crotch."
This makes me laugh, and I am grateful after the horrors of the day.
"I don't even want to know how you can identify that scent. Besides, I can open the windows, air the thing out.
And honestly, I think you're just jealous you didn't think of it first." He looks around the bus, considering the possibilities.
"Actually, yes, I am a bit jealous. I think I've got a permanent bend in my spine from weeks spent sleeping on the ground."
"Well, if you're nice, I'll let you in occasionally."
I waggle a finger in his face. "But only if it's raining." "I'll take what I can get. Besides, I'm just glad you won't be motoring around in this thing. You're an awful driver."
"I am not.
I just like to take my half out of the middle."
Hubert looks over his shoulder.
"Come on, then. Fournier is out there pacing. We'd best see what he wants."
"You have a visitor," Fournier says the moment we step out of the bus.
"Who?"
"Henri Tardiva."
We've not seen the suave little Frenchman since he delivered us to Gaspard's chateau the night we flew in. It was unclear to me at first what role Tardiva plays in the resistance, but I have since learned from Fournier that in addition to collecting counterintelligence and the occasional parachuter, Tardiva leads his own band of merry men in the forest at Allier. The thing, Fournier insists, that makes Tardiva such a spectacular saboteur is that he has perfected a very specific technique in which he targets German supply convoys, letting most of it pass through his bottleneck before attacking the last two vehicles. By the time the main firepower at the front circles back, they are confronted with torched vehicles, dead soldiers, and vanished Marquis. As Fournier tells me, this ensures ravaged supply lines for the Germans and crushing blows to their morale. I liked Tardiva to begin with, but this knowledge has made me very fond of him indeed. And his timing is excellent, because I need to inform him of the target he's been assigned to destroy in the event of an Allied invasion of France. Fournier has his targets already, and has been preparing his strike team since we arrived. Fournier leads us toward his newly acquired tent, thanks to London, where Tardiva sits inside, muddy boots propped up on a stump, arms behind his head.
"Bonjour. I don't know how you stand that track," he says, motioning across the clearing to the dirt road he's just driven up. "I nearly bottomed out in a rut a mile back. Thought I'd scraped my transmission clean off."
"We'll make sure to have it paved before your next unexpected arrival," I tell him. He grins.
"Aren't you glad to see me?"
"Depends."
"On?"
"Whether or not you plan to drop me into Gaspar's hairy little paws again."
"Funny you should say that," he says,
looking around the tent and then at me, as though surprised to see that I've lasted this long under such rough conditions.
"Nice place you've got here."
"The tent is Fournier's. That bus," I hook my thumb over my back,
is mine.
You're going to sleep in our bus?
I will once I find a mattress.
He gnaws at his thumbnail.
I might be able to acquire a mattress,
if you're willing to barter.
4
Sten guns for my men.
Find me a mattress, a clean one, and I'll request your guns.
I laugh.
But that's not why you're here. Get to the point. What's this about Gaspar?
He despises you.
Tell me something I don't know.
Okay.
Tardivar drops both feet to the ground.
Patrice is dead.
Hubert stiffens beside me, and I'm sure the look on my own face is one of dismay. I am one of only 3 SOE agents in the area who have direct contact with Maurice Buckmaster. The others are Victor, farther north in the Allier region where Tardivar is based, and Patrice in the Auvergne.
What happened?
He was killed last night by a German agent sent to assassinate Gaspar. But the agent has been captured, and Gaspar sent me to ask you if you would like to interrogate him. He said it was an olive branch.
I don't...
Listen, if you want to get information from this German agent, you'll have to come with me. Now. Knowing Gaspar, I doubt he'll be alive much longer.
The distance between Fournier's encampment and Gaspar's is little more than 50 kilometers as the crow flies, but they are separated by rugged terrain interlaced with mountains, valleys, and narrow byways. What should be a 45-minute drive takes almost 2 hours as we creep through half a dozen villages and small towns. There are 2 ways to get to Montmouchet, but we choose to go east, then north in a wide half-circle to avoid the German garrison at Montluçon. The last thing we need is to run across an enemy patrol and have to shoot our way through. As we drive, I give Tardivar his target, the munitions factory near Montluçon, and he fills us in on what happened to Patrice.
Early this morning, a German agent was halted by Patrice at a checkpoint 4 kilometers from Montmouchet. He gave the correct password, then requested to be taken to Gaspar so he could join the Maquis. Patrice and one of his Maquisards got in the car and guided the agent through that tangled mess of roads that leads to Gaspar's headquarters.
How could a German so easily fool the Maquis? Hubert asks.
Because he wasn't German at all.
A collaborationist?
Yes. His mission was to locate, then assassinate Gaspar. And he would have likely gotten away with it had Patrice not noticed the key ring that hung from the ignition.
I lift my gaze from the road to look at Tardivar, but I do not interrupt him or ask for clarification. Tardivar fancies himself a storyteller and appreciates a pregnant pause.
It was engraved with German lettering, he says.
I nod.
Ah, so Patrice would assume that the man he was taking to Gaspar was either a resistance worker who had commandeered a German vehicle, or...
That he was in fact working with the Germans, Tardivar finishes for me. As the captive tells it, albeit under duress, Patrice and his Maquisard began to whisper in the back seat. The agent had his pistol ready beneath his thigh, and the moment he saw Patrice reach inside his coat for his revolver, he turned and fired, hitting Patrice squarely in the throat. Then he shot the Maquisard once in the forehead.
Merde.
I wince.
Unfortunately for the agent, this altercation happened just as they passed into Gaspar's territory. They were surrounded immediately.
What of Patrice? Hubert asks from the back seat.
He died almost immediately. But he did manage to get 3 shots through the seat and into the agent's back before bleeding out.
This is a terrible blow to the work we're doing, and I feel my shoulders sag. I lean against the passenger side door, trying to think of what this will mean for communications with London and our own responsibilities with Fournier's group. We are already short-handed, and Patrice did the work of 10 men.
I take it none of Patrice's shots hit the mark? I ask.
They did little damage, Tardivar says. The agent was wearing a bulletproof vest.
Of course he was, I mutter. And then something occurs to me.
How do you know all of this?
Tardivar takes his eyes from the road and turns to me. The look on his face is indecipherable. It could be relief or disgust, pride or horror.
Gaspar and his men have been torturing him for information.
The first thing we notice when we arrive at the chateau is the smell of burning flesh. As on our first visit, Tardivar brings his vehicle close to the front door. As soon as we step out of the Renault, the pungent, stomach-churning odor hits us like an invisible cloud. The broad front doors of the chateau are propped open and guarded by two of Gaspar's men. I don't recognize either of them, but they clearly know who we are, because they step aside and motion us in.
Good God,
I say, clamping a hand over my nose as soon as we cross the threshold. Tardivar looks at me with pity, clearly knowing what we're about to see. We step into the chateau and go past the broad staircase toward the kitchen at the back of the large square house. The smell grows stronger with each step, and I can sense a heavy, gagging feeling claw its way up the back of my throat. Still, I am not prepared for the horrific sight that greets us. The agent is stripped naked, spread eagle, and tied by hands and feet to the long, heavy kitchen table where Gaspar and his officers eat their meals. His body is bruised and bloody. He has been whipped and beaten. His face, or what little I can see of it since he's lying on his stomach, has been battered beyond recognition. Two broken teeth lie on the table beside his head in a bloody puddle of spit. But it is the lower half of his body that has me gaping and forcing the bile back down my throat. The unholy stench of burned human hangs so heavily in the air that I have to force my body into stillness. The option of breathing through nose or mouth means I must choose between smelling the air or tasting it. I take the smallest possible breaths through my nose that I can. Still, I stare at the table, trying to make sense of the carnage. By the looks of it, Gaspar's chief lieutenant, Judex, has repeatedly rammed a red-hot poker up the German agent's arse. What remains of his buttocks and thighs is a blackened, bleeding pile of charred flesh. I cannot see his genitals, and I dare not ask why. This is beyond the pale of what one human should do to another, regardless of circumstance, of war, of information gathering. As for Judex, he stands beside Gaspar at the far end of the kitchen, resting one hand on the poker, now cooled to its original black, as if it were a cane and he a debonair gentleman. Both men stare at us, assessing our reactions. The sound that comes from the agent's throat is not human. It is a dialect of suffering known only to those who linger between this life and the next. It is the kind of sound you would not wish upon your worst enemy. Though I suspect Gaspar feels rather differently about that than I do, because he's grinning smugly on a stool 15 feet away. He smokes a cigarette and nods his approval, as though this is the most fascinating thing he's ever witnessed. "What are you doing?" I gasp. I can taste the foul, acrid air the moment it enters my mouth, and I have to grind my teeth to stop the vomit that now threatens to rise with every breath.
"Interrogating him for information," Gaspar says.
"That," I say, pointing one finger at the table, "goes far beyond interrogation. It is torture. Why didn't you just execute him and get it over with?"
"He had our password. We had to find out where he got it and who he is, what he knows, what he's done."
"Have you?"
"Of course."
He taps his ash onto the floor, then takes another drawer.
"Several hours ago."
"And?"
"His name is Roger Le Neveu, a French collaborationist, otherwise known as Gestapo Agent Number 47.
It takes a monumental effort on my part not to gasp at the name, and I mask my surprise by walking around the table and squatting in front of the man tied there. I grip the table leg to steady myself while mentally berating Gaspar for his barbarism and stupidity.
"Quel con celui-là!"
Roger's eyes are swollen shut, and I am grateful because he would no doubt recognize me. And it would be disastrous if Gaspar or anyone in this room noticed. These men cannot know that I have been in France before, that I lived here and have a family, Everyone has at least one pressure point, and mine is named Henri.
Just shoot the poor bastard and get it over with, I say.
Roger's entire body shudders on the table, but I do not think it is fear. I think it is relief. He is a man desperate to die. Gaspard rises from his stool and crosses the floor to where I stand. He moves like a boulder rolling downhill, and his men instinctively get out of his way. I stand and face him.
Why? He demands once we're almost nose to nose.
It irritates me that I have to look up.
This man can be of no further use to you. Do the right thing and let him die. You pity him? I would pity anyone in that condition.
They do worse to our people, he says. We got word this afternoon that the brown shirts slaughtered a woman in term. A pregnant woman.
I know what they did, I snap. I saw it with my own eyes. And this, I point at Roger again, isn't justice. It's you becoming as evil as them.
Gabriel Soutine is my friend, he says.
We should have known that word of what happened in Terme would get out. In many ways, the Marquis communication network is more affected than the BBC. The Bush wireless ensures that what happens in one commune is known in the next within hours. Gaspard snorts.
You do not think this man should pay for what his friends did to Gabriel's wife?
I think he should die for his own crimes.
Well, there are plenty of those. Take your pick.
Gaspard drops his cigarette to the slate floor and stubs it out with the toe of his boot. Then he pulls a folded sheet of paper from his back pocket. He smooths out the creases and begins to read.
Thanks to a bit of creative questioning by Judex, we know that this man, Roger, is responsible for a series of barbaric tortures and assaults on captured members of the resistance. They are numerous and transcribed here. I will let you read them at your leisure.
Gaspard taps the paper with one clean finger. It is so clean, in contrast to everything and everyone around me, that I realize Gaspard has washed his hands, scrubbed them of the filth leaking from Roger's body. He continues.
But there are a few things on this list I think you will be particularly interested in, seeing as how they concern your precious London. This Roger was directly responsible for the arrest of a man named Patrick O'Leary in Toulouse 1 year ago.
I shift my weight against the table. I do everything I can to make the movement look relaxed, not like my knees are about to go out from under me. I force my voice to sound only mildly curious. I know the answer to my next question already, but asking is the only way I can confirm the identity of the man on the table.
And what happened to this O'Leary?
Gaspard looks at the paper.
He was sent to Dachau.
I can feel my peripheral vision begin to blur. Roger, O'Leary, Toulouse. That particular betrayal has probably cost the life of my friend. I look at the man on the table and fight the anger that snakes through my blood.
Go on, I say.
Last night, Roger was responsible for the death of Patrice. I believe you are familiar with him?
I am.
Then that leaves just you and Victor to arm my Maquisard, doesn't it?
I ignore the question. I will not talk shop with Gaspard before a tortured, dying man.
Is that all?
There is more. If you think the crimes I've stated already don't justify my actions.
He taps the paper again, then hands it to me. I read the final line on the sheet. It contains a nickname I am all too familiar with. Gaspard saved this most personal bit of information for last.
In addition to myself, this Roger had a second target, a female British operative who obtains weapons and supplies from England. A woman known to the Germans as La Souris Blanche and to the French as Madame André. His mission, once he had killed me, was to locate and then assassinate her.
The glint in his eyes is ruthless.
You.
The white mouse. Roger was after me as well. The Germans have connected the dots.
Keep his confession, Gaspard says when I try to return the paper.
I'm sure your friends in London will want a copy for their records.
I hand the paper to Hubert, but I say nothing to Gaspard.
You should thank us, Madame André. You were next.
I can take care of myself.
It's true. I've been doing so since I was 16. I am not beholden to Gaspard, and I will not pretend that I am.
And you are a fool. Do you understand what you have done? This man was sent by the Gestapo to find you. When he does not return, they will know that he has been either captured or killed. His presence here means they know where you are. They will retaliate in force.
Gaspard does not miss a beat.
Then you will arm my men so we will be better prepared.
Ah, I think this is the reason he sent for me. To Gaspard, this entire war is a game of chess, moves and countermoves. People fall into strategic categories to be used as he sees fit. Clearly, he thinks of me as little more than a pawn. I look him squarely in the eyes and ask, "Are you willing to agree to my terms?" He sneers.
"You have terms?"
"Two of them, in fact."
Gaspard ponders this. I can see him resist the urge to tell me where I can shove my terms. He takes a long breath through his nose, steadying his temper, and his great broad chest inflates.
"I will provide the men. You will provide the weapons. Those are the only terms that need discussing."
I see what's happening. His men. He is not willing to lose face in front of them. And I am not willing to give him an inch. What Gaspard has not yet realized is that he cannot give orders to London. He will receive orders, or he will get nothing. There is no give and take, no negotiation.
"Good luck with the Germans," I tell him.
He opens his mouth to protest, but I have already turned to Hubert.
"I have no questions for Roger. Please do what Gaspard did not have the courage to do and give him a quick death."
Gaspard closes the space between us and clamps one heavy hand on my left shoulder.
"You are making a mistake."
I glance at his hand, then his face.
"Do not touch me."
"You are a weak, soft woman. You have no place in this war."
Gaspard expects me to shrink back in fear, so when I shift my weight, he only grips me harder. What he doesn't realize is that I've lifted my right boot, stuck my hand inside, and pulled out the knife that I keep strapped to my shin. It's a smooth, clean movement, one I was required to practice for hours and hours on end in SOE training. The sharp, wicked blade is pressed into the skin of his wrist before he realizes what I have done. A thin line of blood seeps into his shirt cuff.
"You will remove your hand from me, or I will remove it from your body."
Neither Hubert nor Tardivar has drawn his weapon. They don't need to. I am no damsel in distress. But they do keep a close eye on Gaspar's men. Gaspard lifts one finger at a time, and then his palm. He drops the hand to his side.
"We're done here," I say.
Then I nod at Hubert.
"Do it."
This is no longer a kitchen. It is no longer a home. To my mind, it is and will always be a place of cowardice and torture. I walk from the room without another word, Tardivar on my heels. We're almost at the staircase when I hear that single, merciful shot.
"Easy there,"
Tardivar whispers in my ear as my knees buckle. He places one hand beneath my elbow to steady me. It is a simple, kind gesture amid so much horror, and I'm nearly overcome. I gag once and hot tears burn the corners of my eyes. I take one more wobbling step before I straighten and walk out the front doors of the chateau by his side. Hubert joins us seconds later.
"Gaspard is coming," Hubert whispers in my ear. "Keep it together just a bit longer."
"I'll be fine."
"He's still dangerous, you know. Don't push him too far."
"Don't worry,"
I say quietly as I turn back to the chateau doors where Gaspard is barreling toward us. "I'll stop just short of the cliff." Gaspard steps onto the gravel, filling his lungs, ready for a verbal assault. But he can't inhale and speak at the same time, so I preempt him. You have plotted to murder me in my sleep. You have turned me out of your chateau when you thought I was useless. You have attempted to steal my weapons at my drop zone. And you have taken a routine interrogation to the most inhuman, barbaric extreme. Say one rash word, and you will never receive so much as a pair of toenail clippers from me. I know you are not stupid. I know you understand me. Make your choice and be quick about it, because I have work to do.
He takes two deep breaths through his nose, unclenches his fists.
What are your terms?
They are quite simple, but non-negotiable. First, you must divide your men into smaller groups, each with a leader of its own, and disperse them throughout the Auvergne instead of massing them here. And second, you must prepare an escape route for each group in the event of attack.
I can see he is itching to respond. His entire body is shuddering with the need to defend himself. But I am not finished.
At the moment, you are grossly vulnerable to attack, even more so now given what you have done to Roger. What you consider to be power in numbers is nothing more than a temptation to the thousands of Germans garrisoned around you. You are poorly armed and unorganized, and it will be a slaughter when, not if, they advance upon your chateau. When you have done these two things, and not a moment sooner, I will begin arming your men.
His entire body goes still, even as his face turns an alarming shade of purple. His muscles are frozen with rage. After some moments, Gaspard unclenches his jaw long enough to say,
"It is one thing to accept weaponry and assistance from a femme, but I will not take orders from one."
I do not argue or try to change his mind.
"Have it your way."
Hubert, Tardivar, and I climb into the car and pull away from the chateau. From the back seat, Hubert gives me that universal male grunt, the one that could mean well done, or possibly go bugger your cousin. In this case, I prefer to think he's just congratulated me on my leadership skills. I turn to Tardivar and say,
"Take us into the forest, far enough where we won't be seen by Gaspar's men, and then stop."
I close my eyes and take long, deep breaths through my nose. I am sweating, shaking. He does as I ask, and when we are in the dim, cool shade of the pine forest, parked at the side of the road, I open my car door and vomit onto a bed of dried brown needles. Of all the physiological responses the human body can call upon under duress, this is the one I like the least. Typically, I will go to any lengths not to throw up. I can count the number of times in my adult life that I have done so. Yet here I am, chucking for the second time today. But I can still smell the stench of Roger's burned carcass. It has seeped into my clothes. I can taste it. So I vomit again and again until the only thing left in my stomach is yellow, stringy bile. And then I spit, forcing the acidic taste from my mouth. I want to bleach my mouth. I want to replace all my teeth. Hubert and Tardivar wait patiently as I wipe my mouth on my sleeve, push my damp hair back away from my face, and arrange myself in the seat.
"A word of this to anyone and I'll shoot the both of you," I say.
Nancy Fiocca. Marseille, November 30th, 1939. Our wedding is small and uneventful. Given that I am not Roman Catholic, nor do I have any intention of converting, I exchange vows and rings with Henri Edmond Fiocca at 3 o'clock in the afternoon at Town Hall in Marseille. Witnesses are plucked from the hallway and bribed with bottles of Veuve Clicquot champagne. We do engage in one small bit of petty revenge, however, and insist that the useless official who tried to deny us a marriage license perform the ceremony. He stares at me, pop-eyed, as I meet Henri at the altar wearing a low-cut dress of pure black silk. I have painted my lips a scandalous shade of red for the occasion. Our reception makes up for the simplicity of our wedding ceremony. I am overwhelmed less than an hour later when Henri leads me into the ballroom at the Hôtel de l'Ouvepay. It is draped in chiffon and bathed in candlelight. There is a string quartet and four champagne fountains, one in each corner of the room. But even more important, Frank Gilmore and Stephanie Marsique
are seated at the head table. The sight of my friends brings tears to my eyes, and Henri delivers me to them while he goes to greet his father.
"You came," I say, voice cracking.
Stephanie throws her arms around me.
"I would not miss it for the world, ma petite."
Frank says nothing, but he does place a big sloppy kiss right on my mouth, a benign gesture now that I am a married woman, and blinks back tears of his own.
"I'm happy for you, Nance," he says.
I give him a huge hug and a kiss on the cheek.
"I'm so glad you're here."
Then Henri is at my side again, and we eat.
Oh, do we eat! Breads and salads and soups, soles stuffed with mousseline and sea urchins, then fried until it puffs up like a souffle, roasted cutlets of lamb that were bred to graze on fields near the ocean, so the flavor is of both earth and sea, with meat so tender and rich we cut it with spoons and let it melt in our mouths. Whole beef fillets with braised vegetables and a spiced wine reduction, mushrooms stuffed with crab, grilled artichokes so tender they open like blossoms, and vats of butter to dip them in. Chocolate cake, chocolate souffle, berries and cream, coffee, brandy, endless bottles of brandy. My favorite thing, however, and I am only slightly ashamed to admit this, is that we instruct Antoine to spike old man Fiocca's drinks with Napoleon brandy and Grand Marnier. We mean him no harm, truly, but payback is payback. Henri and I laugh as his mood improves throughout the evening, and he remarks upon the vintage of the champagne and the sweetness of the orange juice. He is fast asleep in the corner by 9 o'clock, and we enjoy the rest of our celebration without the slightest provocation. To feast in the midst of war is no small thing, and to throw such a feast even as we start to feel the effects of rationing is nothing short of a miracle. But this is the only comfort we can give our friends. So we are lavish, and for one night we forget the dangers that are coming for us. And when we can no longer eat or drink another thing, we dance. Frank Gilmore spins Stephanie around the floor in a cumbersome but enthusiastic imitation of the waltz. Fistol dances with his wife, then each of his daughters in turn. Henri keeps me all to himself, never allowing me to dance with any of our friends, denying everyone who asks to cut in. I am his, and he will not share. His hand stays on the small of my back, long fingers stroking the base of my spine. His face is bent into my neck, warm breath drifting between my breasts. When he speaks, it is only to whisper the various ways in which he is about to render me speechless. I am quivering with anticipation, my skin hot and my breath short, when the string quartet ends their final song with a flourish. But there are guests to thank, and we are the last to leave the grand ballroom, well after 3 in the morning. "What now, love?" I ask as he guides me through the lobby.
"I take you to bed."
But I am confused because he is leading me toward the front door and not the elevators. I point at the ceiling. "The bed is that way."
"Non, ma chère. I have one surprise left."
He winks.
"And fear not, it has a very nice bed."
Henri. He has thought of everything, or at least he has tried to. During her long residence at the Hôtel du Louvre Épée, Nancy stayed in one of the luxurious junior suites, but he does not want to take her to bed for the first time in the same place she has slept for so many months. He wants something more personal. So he has prepared his own home for the occasion. It took a bit of time and a small crew of helpers, but as of this morning, he was pleased with the result. For the last 12 years, he has lived in a small one-bedroom flat in the commercial district of Marseille. He chanced upon the space during a tour of a warehouse he was considering buying for the family business. The previous owner built a small apartment on the roof. It would never do for a family, but was perfect for a single man who values privacy. Henri bought the building and has lived in the rooftop flat ever since, a mere 50 feet from his office. Nancy does not ask questions as Henri leads her to a car and gives the address. She curls into his side, and he drapes his arm around her. He buries his face in her hair. He lets himself fantasize about the rest of the night. She is slightly more curious when they pull to the curb in the shipping district, and he leads her into the square stone building with Fioca Enterprises emblazoned above the door. There is a single light on at the end of the hall beside the elevator. From there, it takes a special key to access the top floor. Henri pulls the key ring from his pocket, and they begin the ascent. Neither of them speaks. His bride watches all this with mute curiosity, and then she watches him, searching his face for clues. Nancy gasps when he pushes the grate up and leads her into his home. Henri's flat is the only residence in all of Marseille that offers a 360-degree view of the city, but thanks to its location in the very center of the roof, is entirely hidden from view. There are floor-to-ceiling windows on every wall, but not a single curtain. He and Nancy are surrounded by soft, twinkling lights and a warm glow from the central fireplace. There are candles in the room and lights on the harbor. Henri thought about music, but decided against it, hoping to hear the music of her breath instead. The heavy drumbeat of her heart. That is the song he wants to hear tonight. Nancy drifts from one small room to another. Living room, kitchen, bathroom, bedroom. She stops, inches from the huge, soft bed, and runs her fingers along the coverlet. She turns to him. Her eyes are quizzical, and she tips her head to the side. "You look nervous," she says.
"I want you to like it."
"I love it. How could I not?"
Henri shakes his head. That's not what he meant.
"I want you to like me."
So, yes, he is nervous. Henri has never lacked company, and his company has always been more than willing to offer their bodies for a night in the hopes of securing more. He is no saint, and he feels guilt about this. He does not want to be the sort of man who uses women for his own pleasure and then discards them. Perhaps it would have been different if he had ever felt as though the women who have passed through his life weren't using him as well, pursuing his fortune instead of him. Henri Fioca has, in fact, never courted a woman before Nancy. And at first, he did not seduce her because he kept getting her drunk. Then he realized there was something exquisitely erotic about the anticipation. It's not that he hasn't wanted her. He has ached from it. But this longing and need have created two things he has never experienced before: intimacy and trust. Nancy meets his brazen gaze.
"I would like you a great deal more if you weren't wearing any clothes."
Henri tries not to smile, but cannot help himself. There is a starved look in her eyes, and he is the only meal in sight. Nancy takes a step toward him and rises onto the balls of her feet. She brushes her lips against his. She runs her tongue in the space between them, slides her warm hands beneath the lapels of his coat, across his chest, and up toward his tie. Nancy loosens the knot with nimble, sure fingers.
"Aren't I supposed to be the one undressing you?" he asks, brushing his lips lightly back and forth against hers.
"Is that a rule?"
He laughs and pulls away in order to see her face.
"So I've heard."
She dispatches his tie efficiently.
"I hate rules."
"How about we take turns? An item for an item?"
"No."
Nancy moves her fingers to his shoulders. She is entirely uninterested in his coat and pushes it off and then down so it drops to the floor at his feet. She moves her fingers to the first button at his throat, then the next, and the next, until his shirt hangs open. "I hate cufflinks," she mutters, fumbling with them. He pulls them out and decides that he will never wear them again. Shirt gone. Undershirt gone. And there it is, the first hint of music to Henri's ears. Nancy makes a small sound of pleasure at the sight of his bare chest. She sets her palm against his heart, moves her fingers through the light hair, and then she walks around him in a circle, never lowering that hand, and he feels the heat of her skin touching his. Chest. Biceps. Back. She pauses here to explore the dip that runs from shoulder blades to hips, runs one finger up and down. Up and down. He shudders at the feather light touch. Henri Edmond Fioca stands in the middle of his bedroom, eyes closed, breath caught in his throat, as his wife of 12 hours presses her lips between his shoulder blades. She opens her mouth, running the tip of her tongue all the way to the hollow of his back. He could explode. He could die. He could spin her around and consume her. He doesn't, because this is the kind of seduction he has always longed for. Once her circle is complete, Nancy asks, "What are you thinking?" He doesn't even know what he's trying to say. How would he even explain what is going on inside his mind, his body? Well, that's evident enough, and she has figured it out on her own now that she's undoing his belt, the button at his trousers, his zipper. Henri had not expected that the groaning would come from him first. Nancy drops to her knees and lifts one of his feet, then the other, dispatching his shoes and socks efficiently. Given her view from that angle, his feet are the least interesting thing about him. She is grinning, and he is helpless. Back on her feet, she hooks her thumbs into his waistband and yanks. His trousers fall away easily. His underwear less so, but she is undeterred. After a moment, he steps out of them and finds himself completely naked before the only woman he has ever loved. How vulnerable it is to be disrobed first, to be seen first, to be touched first, to have your body's reactions seen and recorded and enjoyed first. He cannot take this any longer. Please. Henri is desperate now, his need raw and urgent. "Lie down," Nancy tells him. She places that warm palm against his chest and walks him backward toward the bed. When he bumps up against it, she shoves him lightly. He falls to his back and scoots into position until he's resting on his elbows. "What are you doing? Shh. Just watch." One by one, she takes the pins from her hair until it falls to her shoulders in waves. She combs her fingers through it, shakes her head, lets a section fall across her eyes. She takes out one earring, then another, and tosses them to the carpet. This dress is the most revealing thing Henri has ever seen her in. Like the dress she wore the night they first danced the tango, it is open in the back, all the way to her waist. She commanded the room tonight, and he could not even be upset that every man present appreciated the view, because he knew it belongs to him alone. How he ever earned that right is a mystery he will puzzle over until his dying day. Henri's entire body is throbbing. His lips burn from where she last kissed him. His ears are ringing as Nancy slides her hand around to the button at the small of her back. One button, one 3-inch zipper. Nancy shifts one shoulder, then another, and the black silk flutters to the floor. She steps out of her dress as though dropping a towel. Henri has always considered himself well-spoken and articulate, until now. She wears nothing underneath her gown and is so beautiful, he could weep. "It could help with the shoes," she says with a wink, "since you were so eager to undress me." Henri Edmond Fioca slides off the bed and kneels before his wife. He unbuckles each of her shoes. He bends his forehead to her knees, cradles each calf in his palm, and lifts her feet, sliding the shoes carefully off. Then he drags his nose upward, gratified that it is her turn to breathe heavily. Ah, music to his ears. Her arms hang limp at her sides, head thrown back, eyes closed. So he scoops her into his arms, lifts her off the floor, and carries her 3 steps to his bed. Henri sets her as gently as possible on top of the coverlet. And then he surveys his bride. All the wondrous curves, the rises, the dips and hollows, smooth skin and pink cheeks. He crawls onto the bed and curls himself against her side. He drops one hand to the indentation of her waist and slides the other beneath her head. "I love you," Henri whispers, "more than my own life, more than anything at all." And then he kisses her. It is his turn to be in charge, to explore with his tongue. But it is her turn to beg. "Please." "No," he refuses, playing her own game and mastering it on the first try. Oh, the places he could take that hand. Up, down, around. He spins his fingertips in tiny circles, deciding, relishing the goosebumps that rise to greet the pads of his fingers. Up, across her waist. Fingers splayed, covering as much skin as possible, playing with the small gaps between ribs, listening to her breath come in little gasps as she waits. He stops just below the swell of her breast, allowing his middle finger to brush the soft skin beneath. "Henri?"
"Yes."
"Henri?"
"Yes."
She pulls away from his kiss. "Please touch me." He does. And then he does a great, great deal more, until they are both sweating and limp and cursing and entirely plundered of emotion and pleasure, until they curl into each other, arms and legs woven, lips swollen, breath mingling, hearts slowing, as sleep consumes them whole.
Marseille, January 1940. We honeymooned in Cannes. The day after our wedding, Henri checked us into the Hotel Martinez, and we did not leave for 2 full weeks. Much of our time was spent in bed, but during the day we also made it to the beach or the marina, and in the evenings to the casinos. We took day trips to Saint-Tropez and Monte Carlo. Sometimes we left the hotel for dinner, but often we ordered room service and ate it in our robes on the balcony as Picon and Grenadine scurried around our feet, nipping up the crumbs. We had a corner room that faced the sea and the port, with mountains in the distance. We could see everything happening on the Croisette, and we watched the sleek yachts sailing in and out of the bay for hours at a time. It was perfect. 14 days suspended in time, But, like all things, it had to end. And now we are at home in Marseille, trying to prepare for the inevitable. It doesn't feel as though we are actually at war, I say, setting a platter of what used to be pork loin on the table. Henri looks at my pitiful attempt at cooking, but doesn't comment. His skeptical glance does not go unnoticed by me, however. Have I never mentioned that I cannot cook? He tries not to laugh. I don't believe it ever came up. It's your fault, really. All that wining and dining. I never had the opportunity to experiment on you. Henri pokes the charred roast with his fork. It certainly looks like kitchen chemistry. I did try. I push the platter to the edge of the table. Shall we have cheese and wine instead? Please. I take the platter to the kitchen and then dig around in one of the cabinet drawers for a pen and notepad. What are you doing? He asks. Making a note to schedule cooking lessons. That's not necessary. You don't have to cook if you don't want to. I know, and I wouldn't, but... What? It's a basic skill, and I'll need to have it if we're to make it through what's coming. I can't go around burning our food all the time. It won't be long before there are food shortages throughout the entire country. Is that why you've been stockpiling? Other society wives in Marseille spend their days making the rounds of dressmakers, hairdressers, and tea salons. They meet for lunch and aperitif, acting as though if they ignore the thing, it will go away. I've never been good at pretending, however, so I spend my time making friends with the butchers and bakers along the Canebière. I buy more sugar than we need, more coffee, more tea. I buy foodstuffs by the sackful and pack them into every cupboard and closet in our home. I buy cheese by the wheel, I buy canned goods, and enough cigarettes to stock a tobacconist's shop. Rice, beans, flour. I have turned our spare bedroom into a cellar, and it is bursting with every imaginable aperitif and liquor, as well as hundreds of bottles of wine. I buy them by the case. Each time I go into the city, I visit a shop and strip a shelf bare, carrying what I can, and then having the rest delivered to our new flat. I try not to think what it will cost us each month, but the view, overlooking all of Marseille and the harbour, comes with a high price tag. Henri does not comment on the rent, my acquisitions, or the bills I have sent to his office, but I did catch him standing before a packed wardrobe shaking his head one afternoon as he went to put away his jacket and found the entire thing crammed to the edges with sacks of coffee. Henri joins me in the kitchen, and we compile a rudimentary charcuterie board, which we consume standing up as we lean against the counter and sip our wine. A nice, savoury Sangiovese that Antoine recently imported from Italy. I take a moment to savour the wine. It tastes like clove and cherries, with a hint of dark chocolate. I sigh, then open my eyes. They've been calling this the phony war. Who has? The other women in the building. His lip twitches. Your friends don't believe a real war is coming? I pluck a piece of cheese out of his fingers and eat it myself. They are not my friends. They are bored old women with more money than sense. But there isn't much happening. It's easy for them to forget. Plenty is happening. It's just not happening here, Henri says. The Germans have invaded the Czech lands. They have bombed half of Poland. No point wishing that on us. You have forgotten something. What? Men are being called up all over the country. Yes, they are. It's only a matter of time before you'll be called up as well. The thing about marriage, I am learning, even this early on, is that so much is said without words. The gift of emotional intimacy is that you can read each other's face from a distance. My throat goes dry at the look on his now. That time has already passed, Henri says. He offers a half shrug, but fails in making it look nonchalant. You've gotten your papers? He nods, once, sadly. Yes. When? In November, a week before our wedding. Henri pulls me to his chest and wraps his arms around me, tight, to muffle the insults I am hurling at him. I pound his arms with my fists. The tears that soak into his chest are ones of anger, not fear. The person I trust most has lied to me. As far as betrayals go, it is minor, a mere paper cut. I know this, but still, it stings.
I should have told you. I know that, he says. But it would change nothing, and I didn't want you to worry.
You didn't want me to change my mind about the wedding.
He laughs. We both know nothing would have changed my mind. No, he says. My deployment was deferred. I just wanted to give us a short time of normalcy to be married before this war changes everything.
As soon as Henri releases me, I step back and dry my face with the backs of my hands. I take a deep breath and growl on the exhale.
When do you leave?
In March. We still have time. Let's just enjoy it, please.
I can feel that old familiar stubbornness wash over me, and it is met with a thought so intriguing, so impractical, that I embrace it immediately. I sniff, stand up straighter.
I know what I want for my wedding gift.
Henri squints.
What?
A truck.
And where will I get a truck?
Silent laughter is rippling across his face, so I glare at him.
You will give me one of the dozens that belong to your shipping company.
He pops a bit of cracker into his mouth.
I will?
Yes. And then you will have it converted into an ambulance.
What for?
So that I can drive it to the front and be of some use while you're away.
You will drive to the front?
And ferry the wounded to field hospitals, yes. Poor Henri. He doesn't realize that I'm completely serious. He thinks this is a game. So he needles me.
You can better help the war effort here.
Don't be stupid. Here I help no one.
I do recall that your first job was as a nurse.
A nurse's assistant for 2 months over the course of one summer, and I was 15. Besides, it's not as though the wounded will be pouring into Marseille.
At least not yet.
I can see that both of us are thinking this, but neither of us says it aloud.
But why would you even want to help? War isn't for women.
I lean very close to him and lower my voice to a dangerous pitch. And yet we suffer most in them. Henri sees the flash in my eyes and takes a solid step backward. He throws his hands up in surrender. He tries to laugh off his ignorance.
Haven't I told you how I won the last war for France? Now I will win it again. Have you no confidence in me?
Certainly, I say, giving him a saccharine smile. But I'm sick of hearing how you won the last one. I will win this one.
You and what army?
It's a good thing he's smiling, that a teasing glint is clear in his eyes, otherwise I might swipe at him with a cheese knife.
I'll build my own army if I have to. Besides, I don't see why I should have to wave you a proud goodbye and then sit at home knitting balaclavas.
Henri thinks for a moment, knowing better than to try to dissuade me.
I will give you your ambulance on one condition.
Ah, that word again. The use of conditions is now one of our favorite bargaining tools.
Which is? That you promise me you won't go unless France is invaded. No running off to Belgium to help on that front just because you're bored.
I stick out my hand, and we shake formally.
Deal.
You might think there was a cactus growing directly between my eyes by the way he is looking at me. He shakes his head.
You are the damnedest woman I've ever met.
Poor Henri. He does not realize that I am serious, or how determined Germany is to spread its cancer across the face of the earth. I saw what they did in Vienna and Berlin, and I know that Hitler has no intentions of stopping at Belgium. If Henri is going to war, so am I.